You shouldn't need a game plan just to get out of the car. Joint Relief Institute can help you. Fast, non-surgical, immediate pain relief and covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
This week, the U.S. Supreme Court completed its term, and when it completes its term, it comes down with a Lollapalooza of decisions, and we're going to be talking about some of the more important ones and the interesting ones. And with us to break down these rulings, what they mean, is one of the most prominent Supreme Court scholars in the nation, Chicago's very own, Professor Carolyn Shapiro. She is the founder and co-director of Chicago-Kent College of Law's Institute on the Supreme Court, and she served as Illinois Solicitor General. She's argued before the U.S. Supreme Court herself. She's a regular legal commentator, and she publishes in national news publications and the Chicago Tribune. Professor Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us on this 4th of July weekend.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for that generous introduction.
And it's all true, so that's good. let's start with birthright citizenship. That was the one that just got a lot of press, and I kind of want to break it down a little bit more for our listeners about what birthright citizenship really is, and not to go into the full history of it, but how in-depth is this ingrained in our country's history?
It's very much ingrained in our history, in particular since the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868. The 14th Amendment was designed to do a lot of things, but one of the things it was designed to do is ensure that the freed slaves would be understood to be citizens of the United States and of the state that they lived in. And that was necessary because of the Dred Scott decision from 1854. Many of your listeners may have heard of that. It was a decision in which the Supreme Court held that African Americans, essentially free or enslaved, could not be American citizens as a result of the subordinate nature of their race. It's a really quite ugly opinion. And part of the point of the 14th Amendment was to make clear that that was not the law.
And so this birthright citizenship, what does it actually mean? Just give us the bottom line on what it means in terms of when someone is born in this country, when do you become a citizen? At what point?
You become a citizen at birth. What the 14th Amendment says, the relevant part of the 14th Amendment says, all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So if you are born in the United States, you are automatically a citizen.
Regardless of the citizenship of the parents, they could have been born somewhere else. I mean, there's probably some exceptions to that, but basically that it doesn't matter where your parents were actually born or if they're legal or illegal, correct?
Correct. That's correct. And that's how it's been understood. Certainly, since the Supreme Court decided a case called Wong Kim Ark in 1898.
Okay, so let's go to the issue of, to me, the language is very clear, and I don't think I'm the only one who read it this way, and I'm certainly not a scholar like you are, but the court, when President Trump issued his executive order on the first day he was in office in the second term, he basically said there is no birthright citizenship or words to that effect. So many of the courts struck that down or put it on pause, knowing that and believing that it was a blatant violation of the Constitution. If it was so blatant, what were the arguments in the Supreme Court by the Trump administration to support this executive order?
Well, they focus on the words subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which does limit the sort of all persons born in the United States. So what does that mean? And they argue that it means that only somebody who is what is called domiciled in the United States, that this is their permanent home, is subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. That comes as a surprise to people who are here and have to obey the laws of the United States. And it is not consistent with the small and narrow exceptions that language was understood to mean in in the 1860s, and then was reiterated in the 1898 opinion that I mentioned earlier, Wong Kim Ark.
So if we did want to get rid of birthright citizenship, I mean, I think I hear people say, and I don't even know that it's true, but that people come here for birthright tourism, that they come here pregnant because they know if they have a baby here, then their baby is going to have U.S. citizenship. I don't know if that is a case. Is that a thing? I've never seen any statistics on it that to me are credible. But if we did want to get rid of birthright citizenship, what would have to happen?
Well, at this point, it would require a constitutional amendment that which requires two-thirds of each House of Congress and three-quarters of the state to ratify it. Having said that, this court has made it is Exhibit A for the fact that depending on who is on the court, sometimes the constitutional law shifts. So, depending on personnel changes on the Supreme Court, they might overrule. You know, it's not implausible that this opinion could be overruled. It was 5-4 on the constitutional question.
You tuned out a little bit, but it was 5-4, right?
On the constitutional question,
and
yes.
that's a pretty close call. It's about as close as you get, right? If there's 9 on the court,
yes.
So you're right. So it could come up again, and it seems like we've seen a lot of precedents that have been in place for years and years, like Roe versus Wade, et cetera, that have been overturned, and that is not supposed to happen very often because we rely on precedent in making our laws and upholding our laws. Let's take a break. We're here with Professor Carolyn Shapiro. She's with the Chicago Kent College of Law's Institute of the Supreme Court. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the late voting ballots. And this is something else, too, that I think we really need to explain what the limited precedent is set in this case. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about what it's like to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court, and what do you think the court is, where the court is going, and why have we lost confidence in our Supreme Court? We'll be back in a minute on WGN. We are here today with a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law, Professor Carolyn Shapiro. She's an expert on Supreme Court law, and I want to talk about the late voting ballot case. Professor Shapiro, can you tell us what was at issue in this case?
Sure. Like many states, Mississippi allows counts absentee ballots that arrive after Election Day as long as they are postmarked by Election Day. Illinois does the same. Different states have different rules. They have different lengths of time during which they will accept late arriving ballots. And the challenge in this case was happened to be to the Mississippi law. The plaintiffs in this case, which was the Republican National Committee, said that receiving in federal elections, so specifically when in the elections where we elect the president and our members of Congress, it violates, it's inconsistent with the federal law setting the date of the election to allow for these late arriving ballots. So that it was a question about how to read the federal statute. What did it mean when Congress set a date for the election? And so that was not a question about what the Constitution says or allows. It's just a question about that statute.
So if it says Election Day is this day, does it mean that the votes have to come in at or before Election Day, or is it okay even if they're a little bit late after the Election Day, as long as they're postmarked prior to or on
Correct.
Election Day? And this, and just, you know, for purposes of fact checking here, I heard people all over the place saying, oh my gosh, this is fraudulent, but votes are coming in late. But this is common in many states, is it not?
It's very common. I think there's something like 30 states that allow late arriving absentee ballots. And there's really absolutely no evidence that these late arriving ballots are in any way fraudulent. It would be extremely difficult, and I really can't to imagine how a late arriving ballot is more likely to be fraudulent than a ballot that arrives on or before Election Day. And the mail-in ballots, in general, for that matter. I've actually sat and observed election officials counting mail-in ballots, and they are checking every single ballot against the voting rolls very, very carefully. But if there are concerns about fraud or concerns about the fact that some people are concerned about fraud, the law can be changed. It can be changed at the state level, and it could be changed at the federal level with respect to the federal elections. But the majority opinion, which said the Mississippi law is okay, said that very clearly. It said, look, this is not a question about what is good policy. This is a question about what the law, this law that Congress passed, what it actually requires. That's the only question we're answering. And the answer to that question is the ballots that arrive after Election Day but postmarked by Election Day can be counted if the state law provides for that.
And Justice Amy Coney Barrett was the author of this opinion, and it is a really kind of interesting opinion in pieces because it really goes back and gives a little history about mail-in voting. And I was surprised to learn that mail-in voting started back in the Civil War era days. That surprises me.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating history. And she also talks about how originally voting was done in person only, and it was not a secret ballot. People would gather on election day, and they'd sort of vote in public. In part, that was one way that they thought they could eliminate the possibility of fraud, because people knew each other, and so they'd know who was there. But over time, obviously, that changed. And during the Civil War, people in some states felt that they had soldiers out there, risking their lives for the Union, and that those soldiers should be able to have a say in the government that had sent them there. So they allowed for absentee voting, some of it by mail, and some of it by sending people into the field to collect ballots cast by the soldiers.
Yeah, and I think if we're looking at this issue, we have to really look at the facts because, I don't think there's any reason not to say that everyone who wants to vote in this country should be able to vote, right?
So everybody who's eligible, yes.
Everybody who's eligible, right? So right, yeah. If you are a senior citizen and you can't make it to the polls because it's five blocks down the way and it's snowy and slippery, or maybe you're disabled, or maybe you're blind, or maybe, you're going to be out of town, mm-hmm. or you've got emergencies, whatever it is, this mail-in ballot is the way to do it and to encourage people. And I guess I just have not seen the idea that there's voter fraud. And whenever you see voter fraud, it's like, it's pathetic. It's like 22 votes out of, 10 million or something. So, it just doesn't seem to be the epidemic that I think some people would have you think it is. But
I think that's absolutely right. The evidence of any voter fraud is minuscule. And even people who have worked really hard to find that evidence because they've been very concerned about it have really been unable to come up with more than one or two examples here or there, and it's important, I think, when you're thinking about that, because I could imagine somebody saying, well that could swing an election if it's a very, very close election. And of course that's possible, unlikely but possible. But it's also the case that all the people you've talked about who want to be able to vote and can't vote, if they can't vote, that could swing an election. And there are many, many more people who would likely be unable to vote if we didn't have absentee ballots and mail-in ballots. That number just swamps by, orders of magnitude the number of, the teeny tiny minuscule number of examples of actual fraud.
Let's talk generally. We're getting some texters in who on both sides of the aisle here, and it just kind of proves my next point, which is the studies that we've seen coming out of all different polling organizations show that the confidence in the Supreme Court has dropped to the lowest of that I've ever seen it, and maybe even the lowest since they've been doing polls, which is around 35%. Mm-hmm. Why? What do you think the reason is that people have lost confidence in the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's a little hard to give one single reason, but one reason I would say for some people has to do with the way the court has changed law rather dramatically on issues that people care about a lot. And in particular here, I'm thinking about overruling Roe versus Wade. I think, you know, obviously I imagine you have some listeners who think that was the right call by the Supreme Court, but it was a 50-year-old precedent, and the overruling has caused a fair amount of chaos in the states in terms of what the law now is and how women who want to access reproductive health care can do so. So there are certainly people who think that decision was very wrong, and because it's a decision of such great importance and magnitude, I think some people react to that. I think other people are reacting to the fact that the Supreme Court has been extremely deferential to President Trump in a large part on some of the cases they decided this spring, but also on what people sometimes call the shadow docket or the emergency docket. And what that is where lower court said, president or the executive branch, that you can't do such and such, or at least you can't do such and such while this case is proceeding to determine ultimately if such and such is legal. There have been a large number of courts that have said that to this administration, in large part because this administration is doing things that no other administration has ever attempted, many of which I would say are illegal or unconstitutional. And the Trump administration has gone to the Supreme Court for what are called emergency stays much more frequently than anybody has ever done before. And the Supreme Court has been granted a majority of those requests, and often without explanation. So I think there are some people who are watching that and are saying, gosh, this court is giving him everything he wants and doing it in a way that is really inconsistent with the precedent and with the criteria they're supposed to be applying.
Professor, like we have about a minute, really, and I just want to hear your answer to this question. Is there something that can you take the prejudice out of a judge? I mean, you clerked for a federal court appellate judge, Judge Posner, who was an excellent jurist. Can you take away someone's preconceived notions, where they came from, what their race is, what their gender is? You got about 30 seconds to answer that big question.
No, of course not. And judges come in, judges and justices come in. They've been thinking about the law for a long time. In fact, if they haven't been, they would be disqualified. They come in with judicial philosophies, ideas about what the law should be, and we should be talking about that when presidents nominate them.
Absolutely. Professor Carolyn Shapiro, we didn't have enough time, but I really appreciate you coming on this 4th of July weekend. Please join me again soon.